Hello, this is Osman Parvez with House Einstein, and this is podcast number 9, and I'm here with Hamish Crabb.
Hello, everyone.
The topic of our podcast today is one that realtors are hesitant to talk about, and frankly, socialized or discouraged from discussing. There's a culture of secrecy around. Today we're going to be talking about commissions and commission structures in the real estate industry. And before we get started, I will add that this podcast is not financial advice. It's not legal advice. It's not real estate advice. It's best to be considered as humor, and we'll do our best to be entertaining. In other words, don't sue us for anything you hear about in this podcast. If you'd like legal, financial, real estate advice, please seek the appropriate professional of your choice instead of listening to our podcast and then pursuing us afterward. That's the disclaimer the attorneys that advise this industry would like me to mention, especially if we're talking about something as fraught with litigation and tension as commission structures, because so much of the industry is built on it. And I'll start this podcast with a little bit of a backstory, and it's about how I got into real estate. And when I saw how much the brokers were making in the office that I worked for, and I was an analyst at this office, we were involved in a commercial development. That's what I was brought on for, to help build financial models for a private club on Nantucket called the Westmore Club. I was also asked to help with the brokers and their marketing. And I realized that I was able to do what they were asking me to do, financial analyses of comparable sales, pitch books, that sort of thing. And they really weren't that professional, and they weren't working very much. And I was working crazy hours, at least I thought were crazy at the time. But now I look at how many hours a week I work, and it's not even close. But as a 20-something, late 20-something, having left the investment community in New York and in Boston, I was kind of enamored with this. It's like, well, you know, this seems to be an opportunity to work on social skills and jump into this business. And at the time, I thought, all right, well, 6% commissions, which is what we're being charged in Massachusetts at the time on Nantucket, there's no way that that's going to continue because of how high that commission is. And I also felt like the technology side of this was changing so rapidly that FSBOs would increase in numbers, that this was time limited. And I kind of envisioned the real estate commission model being a 10-year thing, to be honest. But the opposite happened. So I've always been prepared to go back onto my financial skills and go back to work for an investment company if real estate didn't pan out. That was a long time ago. This is 20 plus years ago. I felt like, all right, let's give it a try. And worst case scenario, if realtors are made redundant by technology, then I can always fall back on my real estate investment skills. But the opposite happened. If you look at the statistics, the percentage of people that sell by themselves for sale by owner has dropped, not increased. And I've been benchmarking against my competition here locally in Boulder since I got started in real estate here in Boulder in 2005. And what I have seen is that the top agents in town, the top 10% of agents here, do about 70% of the business. So it's not quite an 80-20 rule, but it's close. And meanwhile, there are many, many agents, often whose names I don't recognize, that do one or two transactions a year here in Boulder. And they're sort of part-timers. They are people that hang their licenses with large brokerages like Coldwell Banker and REMAX and Compass. It's not to say that they're not top agents at those companies. They are. There are many top agents at those companies. But the vast majority of agents at those companies are not top agents. They are they're rookies that have hung their license there to get the credibility that those brands offer them. And that's the real estate industry. That's how it works with these large brokerages, that they pay a large percentage of their splits to the brokerage. And what they're getting is this branding and this I'm going to say it.
This
credibility, but illusion of competency as well. Like, they, they're credible. Hey, I'm a Remax agent. I'm a Coldwell agent. I'm a Compass agent.
And therefore,
But the truth is, I only do, you know, 3 deals a year. And before being a licensed real estate agent, I didn't do anything professional at all related to real estate. I was a truck driver. It doesn't matter what they were. And often people do leave their first job and switch to real estate. It's not an uncommon second job pathway. So commissions, how does that all fit into this? Well, as most people know, the vast majority of agents don't survive. 75% or so fail within the first 3 years of trying this business. So there's massive turnover. And the commission model is taught to young agents. So even though the majority of agents in the industry are independent contractors, just like the agents in our company, except for you, Hamish, are independent contractors who set their commission, there's a lot of pressure on these agents to keep commissions high. And only recently, from the brokerage community, it's subtle, but it is something that, especially if you're only going to do one or two deals a year, if you discount that commission, there's not enough meat on the bone in most markets for those agents to survive. And certainly there's not enough meat on the bone for the brokerages to survive while they're providing high levels of service, in theory, to their agents. So there's a lot of pressure to keep commissions high. And recently there there was, I believe as a result of a lawsuit, there's now more transparency for buyers on what commissions are being paid. So if you go to Zillow, you can actually see the commission that is offered to the buy side. The listing agent side commission is not disclosed, but at least the buyers can see the commissions. That really hasn't resulted in much change, but there is regional differences. So for example, up in Breckenridge, where we've recently started doing more business, commissions pretty much across the board are 3% to the buy side. And most agents are likely charging 3% as well. So that is a luxury market. It's a niche market. It's retaining its 6% commission model. Down here in Boulder, most buy-side commissions are still 2.8. The vast majority of them are 2.8. But down in Denver, the vast majority of buy-side commissions have fallen to 2.5. But again, in theory, an independent contractor can negotiate the commission directly with the seller, and the vast majority of deals are structured so that the seller pays commissions. When I first got into this business, when I was a young buck, I thought, well, you know, I get incentives are not aligned here. And so I'm more than happy to do something creative with a client, and we can do a variable commission structure to make our commissions much more aligned. And what I found when I offered that to my clients is none of them, that was not a deciding factor in who they chose ever. It was something that they asked about, but when they actually came to structuring something that took into account incentives and making sure that they were aligned, they were very uninterested in actually doing that. What they really wanted to know is who's the best agent for the job. And if we were the winner, it wasn't about the commission. And so this is what was interesting and still is interesting. The vast majority of deals are done by a small percentage of agents. And those agents, large and by, don't discount very much. They may discount a little bit. But typically, it's a small number. And the level of service difference is shockingly high. So this is one of those things where, and I could say this because I know all of the agents in Boulder that are the top agents, the variability in service is dramatic, and the difference in commission is small. So you should interview agents, you should talk to people, and make an intelligent decision on who you want to represent you in the sale or the purchase.
And we've got a whole podcast on that too, number four.
We do. Interview questions. And so this podcast is predicated on somebody asking us about variable commissions. And it's the first time I've, you know, had that question in a long time. And one of our competitors who we trust a lot apparently is offering a variable commission. I won't mention her name, although I do respect her a lot. She's really smart. And supposedly the structure, and we didn't see the details, but looks something like we set the target price, and if the target first, we pay the buy side the standard, so we're not going to discount the standard buy side. And the reason you don't want to do that is there are a number of disreputable agents that if they see the commission is a discount commission, they're going to actively push against this deal. And you're not, like, they're going to be unenergetic, uninterested, and so they're going to steer their clients toward other houses that offer the norm. So you really don't want to offer less than what most sellers are offering in your market, because you will find the buyer pool is dramatically low. Yes, that whole pattern lacks integrity. That's wrong, but that's still what happens. So you probably want to offer the standard commission in your market. But this variable sell side commission, so what the listing agent would get, I hadn't heard before. It's novel, and I kind of like it, but it has some downsides. So basically it works like this. You and your agent determine the price of the house together. And if she is able to beat that price by a significant number, then her commission goes to 3.2. So the total commission to you is 6%. If we hit the target number, her commission is 2.8%. And if we drop below a certain threshold, she will also discount her commission by an unspecified amount. So therefore, the incentives are aligned for this agent, in theory, to go for the bidding war. Push the sale price higher.
And just to recap, too, 2.8 is essentially the industry standard here in Boulder. So right on the target is right where you line up.
Yep, but we don't say industry standard.
No.
Because it's not. Okay. Realtors are not sitting in dark rooms smoking cigars and agreeing that 2.8 is the standard. Yet 2.8 is what the vast majority of agents are charging. So there's no grand conspiracy to keep it at 2.8. And your agent could be negotiable, and you should negotiate if you feel like that's the most important thing to you. But you will rapidly find out, at least in my experience, that the top agents don't negotiate on this. Mm. You're choosing the wrong things to negotiate on. And the difference between, let's say, 2.5 and 2.8 is trivial compared to a higher sale price, a smoother sale process, less legal liability, shorter time on market, all of those things. Like, what marketing are they doing? Whether it's 2.5 or 3.5, what marketing are they doing? What expertise are they offering? Those are the things you should be focused on. And what you'll find is the competency, if you've first filtered for competency and quality, and then you filter for commission, the commission's gonna be very, very similar, almost identical between agents. So it's really not what you should be focused on when you're first interviewing agents. What you first should be filtered on is that whole podcast of questions. Yeah. How long have you been doing this? What are your credentials? And all the trick questions we put into that podcast. What was that podcast? 4, 5?
Yeah, 4.
It's 4. So we'll put a link into the show notes. We're starting to put show notes together, so they're delayed a little bit, but we will put show notes together, and that link will be at least in the YouTube description, Hamish. We should make sure that link is there to the other podcast. So here's the problem with this particular variable structure, and I'm sure many of you have already figured it out. It actually incentivizes the listing agent to list it low, which is 100% aligned with her interest. Sell it fast, sell it for a price that nets me 3.2. So if you intentionally price your house low and you add in professional marketing, you will sell your house very quickly, but you may leave money on the table. And the fact that it's priced low will attract a certain element of buyers, and you're much more likely to have a shorter sale process. So 100%, that's in the agent's interest, is to price it low, get a bidding war, and then collect the 3.2 and sell it fast. So rather than incentivizing interests or aligning interests, in some ways, you've actually counter-aligned interests. You've selected a structure that encourages a low list price. And you've now seen this a couple of times, Hamish, in the time you've been with House Einstein, where at the last minute, we realized, no, actually, we're priced low. And our initial thought on pricing is wrong. And literally, the day we're going active, we're increasing the price. So for our listing in Arapahoe Ridge, it was $50,000. And for our recent listing in Table Mesa, it was $100,000 that we adjusted our pricing both upwards from what we thought initially. You know, right when we sign a listing agreement, we do an initial pricing analysis. We schedule an hour-long call. It's a video call. We go through the comps together. We talk about pros and cons. Not just on what the comps look like, but on the seller's strategy in terms of timing. And we establish like an initial pricing point where we think it's
going to personally check out the competitors at that time too. You know, if there's like a direct comp or something that we think would be a mirror for the buyers to consider when placing offers. We'll go and see that in person. Yeah. With
we will, and especially right before we go active, because the initial pricing point can be a month or two before we go active. And right before, sometimes the day we're about to hit the go button on the MLS, we're scheduling showings and double checking to make sure that we understand our competitive landscape. And that's where making a $50,000 or $100,000 price adjustment, I feel like I'm one of the most analytical realtors in the market here in Denver and Boulder. And yet I can see that kind of variability at the last minute because you have to price to the competition. Otherwise, all you're doing is selling your competitors' properties.
And when you're saying too about kind of like the insignificance of those certain, you know, it's tenths of a percentage point, when we're talking about having to increase our price by 100 grand on our most recent listing before we go live, all of that extra in the commission's eaten up just because we rose the price and priced it correctly. You know, like there's less loss by doing it on the correct side.
Right.
Yeah.
But the truth is the difference between 2.5 and 2.8 and 3.2 or 3% is trivial when it comes to my business model for how I operate. Mm-hmm. That's what really matters is delivering a high degree of service with integrity, with care, with consistency and improving our systems and having met or exceeded the expectations of our clients. And that means no BSing around what their home is worth. It means being honest about potential, you know, cons and pros of their home, and some of them have some serious cons. It means no smoke and mirrors in our marketing. We're not selling it, we're advising. And that's a whole different approach. I don't know if other agents do that. I don't think they do because their businesses aren't built on that. Their marketing is built on shiny wrappers, and our marketing is built on helping people make smart decisions. So the commission, we benchmark against other top agents, and for the most part, it is a standard offering. If you've done previous deals with us, we may give you a small discount because you've done previous deals with us, and they were trusted deals, or I'm related to you. But otherwise, that's the commission. Affordable housing is the only exception to that in how I price my services. And affordable housing here in Boulder is what you get. And it's pretty much, I put that in my head under the category of pro bono, because effectively that's what it feels like. It's usually three times the level of work, and it's usually far less than a quarter of the normal pay. And the only reason I do affordable housing is because I care about the people that are buying or selling, and I want them to feel like I want them to get services through us, and I'm willing to discount it that deeply, but only with affordable housing, and I don't advertise affordable housing. They're usually people that are already in network, in our client community and our friendship communities. But that's basically it. So House Einstein's a full service brokerage, but there are other business models out there. There are discount brokers, people that will rebate you 50% of the commission. There are all sorts of schemes out there, but as most people's grandparents will tell you after a lifetime of experience, and that is you get what you pay for in life. And there's a degree of negotiation that is intelligent, but when you start going for commission rebate models, huge discounts, flat fee listings, you usually get really horrible service. And we see that when we represent buyers and we're going after a flat fee listing. Like the degree of nonsense that we get from the other side, the degree of unprofessionalism, and the massive amount of money the seller often leaves on the table has blown my mind in 20 years of doing this, over 20 years of doing this. I've seen it time and time again. The probability of the seller losing a lot of money is massive when it comes to these discount models. And one of my favorite stories, so this is right here in Boulder, and it's a client called Kelly. I won't say her last name, but it was right downtown, and it was right after the 4 Mile fire. And these clients, it turned out, we've learned later, had lost their home in the 4 Mile fire and needed to sell this beautiful downtown investment property in order to fund the purchase of their construction project to rebuild their house. And they decided to go the flat fee route. So it's harder and harder to find flat fee, by the way, because the real estate commission says you can't discount services. There are standard services. You can't just cross them off and charge $500 for MLS insertion. So that has actually gone rapidly away because the real estate commission's been all over it. But at this time, this still existed. And this property had been on the market a little while. The market was a little slower. And this client's an investment analyst in real estate, no less, or was. I don't know if she's still doing that. But this condo checked every box and has killer views of the Flatirons. And it had been on the market for like 30 days or whatever, is my recollection. But we lowballed. And it was really interesting because I warned her. I'm like, this offer is so low that the correct answer to an offer this low is to ignore it. Is to say, no thank you, we're not even going to counter. It's so far too low that we're just going to wait for a better offer. There's no point in negotiating with you. And I remember writing the offer. So that this time the contract did not have a time of response. So it was automatically, the offer was invalid as of midnight. And I sent it that to them via DocuSign. And to my shock, and I'd warned my client to expect nothing, right? To my shock, at the stroke of midnight, right before midnight, they signed it. And I couldn't believe it. I was just so blown away with how big of a discount this was. And it turned out they were very motivated. They really wanted the money to go build. And they did not have professional representation that told them, this is a bad move, right? Yeah. Like, counter. It's actually a bad move from a negotiation perspective, even if the number was acceptable. And that's a whole nother podcast, negotiation techniques. But they didn't counter a lowball. They accepted it. And I felt really bad, actually, for that. So this is rare. I represented the buyer. I felt thrilled for my buyer. And I also felt really bad for them because they left at least $50,000 on the table.
Bad for the seller.
Bad for the seller because they left that much money on the table. We were prepared to go up dramatically. And if they had had even a marginally competent listing agent who was skilled in negotiation, he would have separated the emotions and said, look, if they are serious about the property, counter. And we can arm wrestle over the price a little bit. It makes for a better deal. And you won't know how much money you're leaving on the table unless you counter and are willing to let it go. And by the way, this is such a unique product on the Boulder market. There's only one of these condos. Well, there's three. I guess there's three floors. But the top floor, there's only one of them with this view that's protected, by the way, by a park. And now I've given you enough info that you can actually figure out which condo we're talking about for those that follow Boulder real estate. But yeah, it was an astounding deal. And I've seen that pattern not just once, but many times where the discount broker has just, I wouldn't say misrepresented, but not represented because they're not paid to and they're not skilled to. And then in the transaction process itself, it's usually a mess. It's usually three or four different people involved. And the documentation side's a mess. I had a deal, literally, we're driving a moving truck to Burning Man and I had a pullover. Yes, I just admitted I'm a burner. I had a pullover because it turned out that this listing brokerage, which is still active here in Colorado.
Was this last year?
No. Okay. This is way before your involvement, Hamish. This was at least 5 years ago, maybe 7 years ago. And we represented the buyers on a house in Table Mesa, in the Kohler Mesa neighborhood, actually. And this house was funky. It had been on the market a while. They had grossly overpriced it. They went with a discount sign in the yard brokerage. That's the limited service model at the time that existed. And we got, I think, $100,000 off. It was a big discount. And another big discount. So this is another indicator if you want to lowball the discount brokers, because they don't advise their clients very well, at least in my personal anecdotal experience. So we got a big discount on it, and this deal is ABC, all but closed, and I'm in a moving truck on the way to Burning Man when my phone rings, and it's our favorite person at Land Title, who's on the phone with me, and she's like, Osman, we have a problem with this contract. And I'm like, what do you mean? She said, the wife's not on the contract, but she's on title. And I said, hold up. I emailed the listing brokerage and asked about this because I noticed that too. And they said, no. The public records are slow. They're late. It's not accurate. And it turned out that the husband and wife supposedly were in a divorcing situation or something like that. I don't know exactly. But they were not on the same page, even necessarily with selling it. And yeah, so this title person, who I'm not going to name because I don't know if this would get her in trouble or not, but she's like, if you want this deal to happen, you need to send me an amendment to the contract and add the wife onto the contract. And I'm the husband is getting the wife here to the office and I'll have her sign it and we'll be done. And I'm like, okay. And I'll do that. And so the husband got the wife in and she called me. Like, so I pulled over to write this with my laptop. I still remember I was north of Fort Collins. I literally had just left town. We were going the northern route through Wyoming. And she called me because I sent it to her. And she's like, they're arguing. Like, right now, I left the closing room because they're arguing with each other because she thinks the price is too low. And I'm like, she's right. The price is too low, but don't tell her that. That's not your job. Please don't give her legal advice. Just if she wants to sell the property, she needs to sign it, and that's what happened. She put the amendment in front of her, and the seller signed it. So this was just shockingly incompetent on the listing agent's part to not verify that he had the right people on the contracts, and to tell us when we questioned it that no, the wife wasn't on the contract. And then go ahead.
It sounds like the wife was just completely out of the loop on this deal as well. At the same time.
Like I said, I think it was a divorce situation or something similar. They had moved into a different property and they were getting rid of this. And divorces are really challenging because that container of trust is broken. This is special cases file. We have one or two of these a year and they're always very challenging deals. So divorcing couple and discount brokerage is like a recipe for a disaster. And these people left, again, at least $50,000 on the table. My clients decided they wanted to sell this house not even very long after owning it. They moved back to California, and we were able to recoup all of that money and then some, pay for all the commissions and put money in their pocket less than a year later when we professionally marketed the house and professionally negotiated a deal. And they didn't really do any updates to it. They didn't do a lot. They just sat in the house for a year, and we got them all their money back plus $100,000 to cover all commissions and all the rest of that. So it was... and I think they actually made a little money on my recollection, but anyway, I've shared enough about that story.
Crazy.
It's the crazy world of real estate. The title people, by the way, really know who's competent and who's not. So if you want a shortcut the interviewing process to try to find out who's really good in your market, figure out who closes a lot of deals and who's the top escrow person, who's the top title person in that office, and buy them coffee, buy them lunch, get them on the phone, and get them to divulge to you who their top three agents are. And make sure it's not because they're related or they're drinking buddies or whatever. Make sure it's because it's based on experience. Because they see competency and incompetency firsthand more than anyone.
And they don't really have a reason to lie to you either.
Yeah, as long as they're not directing referrals to their friend, they really know who is competent and who's not. So that's the discount brokerage model. We're the full service model, the opposite end of the spectrum. And it's really interesting to try to encapsulate that for people because it's hard to compete with branding that has got, you know, the shiny wrapper, right? The national advertising model. And so we lay it out. Here are the services we do that other brokerages don't do. Here's all of the investment we've made in videography. And not just that, here's the results. And we recently had a listing sort of, I would say, lower end of the market on Galileo in Noble Park. And that video exceeded 4,000 views just on YouTube. And some of that, I mean, a large portion of that is because we're boosting the and getting traffic, and we're boosting it to get local traffic. It's not traffic from nationally.
Only in dramatic, the specific area.
And I showed my client this. I'm like, let me show you a similar quality video. I mean, not quite as good. It didn't have the voiceover, but at least it similar quality footage, right? Similar quality editing. No offense, Hamish, but similar quality. Okay. And that video had like less than 400 views. And it was a $4+ million listing that was like drooling eye candy, gorgeous house that I really wanted to buy because it was surrounded by open space and stunning. Not for anybody other than we're not ready to buy $4.5 million houses, by the way. But if I could have, I would have. This house was stunning. And yet, you know, 400 or fewer views on it, or roughly 400. And I don't know what we're up to on on the Galileo listing, but it's 100x. We're talking about 100 times the market penetration in terms of eyeballs viewing this video than other agents are getting in their marketing. So that's one piece of what you're paying for, is increasing the number of people that actually see your listing. And the other piece you're paying for is competency in negotiation, competency in reducing your liability around things like disclosures, competency in preparing your home for sale. Every one of our listings gets, you know, 50 slide PowerPoint deck on how you should improve the home room by room. And a lot of it might be common sense, but when you've been living in a home, it's your place, you may not see it. And this is a visual checklist of all the things we recommend. And then we add in professional photography, professional videography, massive distribution, a budget for it. And then following up, of course, with showing services, which I think most brokerages do, is professional showing services. But the vast majority of agents are not individually calling for feedback. I know, because it's like one every weekend we see 20 houses sometimes, and I get zero phone calls. One of our competitors did text me last week to ask for feedback. And he didn't call, at least he texted, but the vast majority just send the online feedback form. And the vast majority of online feedback forms are ignored and not useful to actually provide actionable advice to the seller to improve the house.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the key differences. So
they don't convey tone either. You know, a phone call, we always say, like, when you're on the phone with another agent of that property, that's when the negotiation starts, you know, from the very start. Like, you can get so much more out of a phone call. You can get the tone of the agent. You can get kind of a feel for the willingness to negotiate just off the bat.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so this agent asked me to fill out the form, which is unfortunate because it doesn't convey all of what you just said. And this particular listing, you know, I filled out the form. I filled it in the text box. You know, I wrote in three sentences to try to encapsulate it. But he really should have picked up the phone and called me. Because this listing, so the seller invested a few hundred thousand dollars in an amazing kitchen remodel. The style of the home is very unique. But the things that they invested in 20 years ago are unique to them. It's their taste. And that taste does not have a market. If you're excited by 1990s Japanese design, then you've got a market. But I don't really see that here in Boulder. A tea house, a custom tea house of your own, how much more is somebody willing to pay for that? And it doesn't matter to a degree that you spent X dollars on this 20 years ago. If the market doesn't appreciate it, the value is zero. And in fact, the value could be negative because they have to deconstruct all this stuff they don't like or want or repurpose it. So that's a tough message to convey in three sentences. I think that he's got enough listings. Maybe he's just aggregating data and doesn't want to take the time to build community and get the real scoop. So that's what we do with each and every one of our listings. We are tracking the showings and we are personally calling for the feedback. That also means we can't handle 20 listings at once without adding a lot more staff. We are in the top 10% of agents, but we're not, you know, I personally am involved with two or three deals typically a month, not 20 deals a month. There's no way for me personally to make 20 deals, 20 listings. The phone calls would be insane. We would have to add people. And mm-hmm. unfortunately, a junior level staffer is unlikely to get the level of feedback unless they're particularly skilled on the phone. To get the actual nuance, why is this listing not selling? How's the price look? Was there anything wrong with the staging? Were there any unusual smells? How does it compare to the competitors? And most importantly, what would it take to get your client to actually write an offer on this property? And that's what we're doing with every single one of our phone calls. Okay, so that's full service versus discount brokerage. And let's see, licensing, we've covered that. And the turnover rate, the insane failure rate in the industry, we've talked about that. And our grandparents' philosophy, it's old-fashioned, but you get what you pay for. And that's what we do at House Einstein. I feel like we are willing to compete. I've made that clear to my clients, like our prospective clients. Like, if somebody's giving you a better offer, send it to me. Let me look at what they're actually offering you, and also let me benchmark them on terms of their marketing and service and their experience. And show you the difference. And if you choose the other person, I'm fine with it, because ultimately, I also know the value of the service we provide. And this is one of those things. So we've talked about the failure rate, Hamish, of new agents. But we have not talked about the limited experience of buyers and sellers. So most people, the average, I think, is 7 years between when they buy and sell a home. So they have a few transactions as they get older, but they don't really have a good benchmark for how to compare agents. Yeah. So they use their friends for referrals, and they go with the shiny wrapper. That's the easy decision. They see the marketing from RE/MAX that says we represent X thousands of transactions per year here in Colorado. That doesn't really make a difference. It's totally irrelevant. They see a junior agent use the RE/MAX, you know, the pie charts, the bar charts that show what percentage they have. But that's not that agent. It's the whole of RE/MAX's office, which contains hundreds of agents.
A little misleading.
Oh, completely. But that's it's almost like so the comparison for me is mutual fund prospectuses. And if you look at mutual fund prospectuses, they show performance and they say, okay, you know, if you had invested on one specific date or range of dates in a particular year and you sold it in this time period, you would have had this incredible return. So they cherry pick the time period. Right. Oh, yeah. And then there's an army of lawyers and compliance officers that write the disclaimer at the end of that, mm-hmm. because the unless, you know, if you're just average Joe and don't have the financial acumen and don't realize how much shenanigans occurs in the financial community, you would have no idea how much return you give up for high management fees and how unfortunately cherry picked the prospectuses are to show performance. They're usually, you know, you're investing your IRA, your company has chosen an investment advisor, you have three or what, maybe you have 100 options of mutual funds. And you basically just pick one, but the reality of that game is you give up massive amounts of return in, over a 20 or 30 year time period. And the same thing parallel is real estate agents that show you the performance of their brokerage, which contains hundreds of agents, and basically are cherry picking data. And they're not even doing it themselves. Their offices are doing it for them and handing them, you know, the PDFs and the Instagram-sized images and all the rest of that to make them look good. But it's not actually the performance necessarily of that agent. So listen to our podcast on questions to ask agents if you're interviewing agents.
Hey, that's an important note, too. If you're researching an agent on Zillow or something like that, you'll find that Zillow aggregates all their data to the brokerage house. So if you're trying to select a specific agent within the brokerage and you're looking at all the sales and everything, that's not necessarily that agent's listings.
Yeah.
It's a confusing one to look through, and you're not really going to get a good idea of the agent
right.
from Zillow.
Yeah. I mean, Zillow, unfortunately, is a rigged game. And we everyone has to play the rigged game, right? We send the links to you send the links to the buyers and sellers you represented who are definitely going to write you a good review. And if you had a bad deal, you don't send them the links. So you're either going to get 5-star reviews or 1-star reviews because somebody has to be so angry that they're going to go find you and review you on Zillow, excuse me, or Google, or Yelp. So that, unfortunately, you can't rely on the star ratings, and you have to do your own research on who this agent is. You have to ask interview questions, and the best filter, if you have access to it, is a really top-notch title company and somebody within the title company that is willing to divulge who's actually competent and who's not. You can't judge. I mean, age of experience is a good proxy, but it's really, you know, the number of years of doing this is a good proxy, but some of the older agents are really checked out. And there are some amazing young agents that really know what they're doing. And they came from a professional services background before real estate, and they bring it to the table, and it's shocking. I always try to name the good agents, and I will give them shout outs, but I won't name the bad ones, just by category.
Well, our very own Ian, you know.
Oh, Ian for sure, right?
Yeah.
Oh my God, he killed it when he worked in his professional capacity previously in Asia. He's killing it now. He's taking a very analytical approach. A very diligent approach. He's serious about his profession, and it shows. He's starting to ramp up. He grew up here in Boulder, and he will be on the Real Producers cover soon. I'm excited about that as a rising star. That's excellent. I think he's going to be in the top 10% within 3 years because of his level of care.
It's cool to see.
Yeah, and he's ethical. I mean, there's other people that are aggressive. It's like the Venn diagram, aggressive, competent, and ethical. Because there are people that are aggressive and competent, but not ethical. And very those people so. You really want to avoid if you're making your decisions around agents. I feel like we are reasonably aggressive. We are focused on competency. And ethics are not even a question. Like, I just if ethics come into play, I step sideways. Like, we're not doing unethical things. And I just had a conversation with a client today, and I explained to him what he's asking me to do is it may not be ethical, so I can't do that. And I'm certainly not going to jeopardize my license over that. And I don't think he realized what he was asking until I spelled it out. And he's like, oh, I get it. Yeah. You can't do that. I'm like, I can't do that. Yeah.
That's You touched on this a little bit earlier too about how, you know, most people sell their homes or are within their home for about 7 years before going to the next one. And that's where experience is a huge help. And with like our staging consultations, and a lot of it's maybe common sense, but also might be common sense because we're in this business and are doing multiple deals a year. You know, we see things that you wouldn't because you've only lived in, you know, you buy and sell a house so infrequently. Right. It just speaks to our experience, yeah.
Well, it's not a normal house cleaning. Mm-hmm. Like, if someone were to take a photograph of my office and say, and we would run it through our process for the staging consultation, which involves the whole team, you know, it's the amount of things I would have to do to prep this home, just this room for showings.
The sloth has to go.
Oh, it's not a sloth.
No.
It's a river otter.
Oh, excuse me.
and it was a gift from my wife, Hamish. So you better hope she doesn't hear this podcast, because that's not a sloth, that's a river otter.
Excuse me. Yeah. But stuff like that, yeah.
That would be funny to have a sloth as a framed image for the office.
But not too bad.
So to sort of wrap this up on commissions, I can't give you the data to show you the level of incompetency I've run into when it comes to discount brokers. But there's a reason the old saying is you get what you pay for. And my recommendation is to first select for competency, ethics, and service. And if you have to price people or price shop people, price shop them a little bit. But the top agents are not likely to actually discount very much because they know the value of the service they provide. And part of knowing the value is when we negotiate against incompetency, how we see the hundreds of thousands of dollars that could be left on the table by having incompetent representation in the sale process or purchase process of your home. We see it over and over again, and not just with discount brokers who are, you know, the discount sign in the yard people seem to be gone because of the real estate commission, but there are still agents that are incompetent and offering big discounts, and the amount of money they usually leave on the table, and they're usually not the top agents for a reason. Right, you're getting the B or C team when you focus on your first filter is commissions, filter for competency, ethics, and service. And then if you want to price shop a little bit, go for it. But you probably aren't going to see much of a difference. And be careful with how you do it, because you might annoy the service provider, your agent, to the degree that they've had enough. Like, I would be intelligent in how you push on commissions because it may or may not be, you know, you may get a 0.1%, right? Or maybe instead of a 2.8, you're getting a 2.5. But now you've got somebody that's annoyed with this, and you may not be their top priority because they have other people that gladly paid the 3% and didn't annoy them as a client. And are they going to be as motivated to market and sell your home when you've now extracted 0.5%, and now you've turned off your own service provider? There's a downside to pushing too hard on commission negotiations. And like I tell my clients, show me what they're willing to offer you, and I will be willing to compete, provided that they are competent, have integrity, and have a high degree of service in what they do. If they are not those three things, then I've told my clients, prospective clients, this, our commission is our commission. If you'd like to work with that other agent offering you 2%, go for it. I don't have a problem with letting it go. We have plenty of clients that are interested in our services, and we say no often enough because of that reality. We're not the right fit for everybody. So let's see, what have we missed on? We've talked about video, we've talked about photography, social media marketing, the network within Boulder. We have not really talked about that. We talked about how the top agents do the majority of deals. I guess I'll add to that that we know each other, and I do my best to treat the other side fairly with great communication and principles of practice so that they want to do business with us. And I've won bidding wars that way without even going, not without being the highest price, because they know that our transactions are smooth. They know that we manage the expectations of our buyers and sellers professionally, and we don't write offers that they're not realistic about. So having a strong network also means treating your colleagues with respect. So we do that. And I think we've covered, you know, we've covered almost everything in our list. How are we doing? 47 minutes. We could end it without even hitting an hour.
I wanted to touch back, or kind of circle back on the tiered structure, because we kind of like hit the note on the agent could, you know, if you're having your valuation meeting, it also depends on when it happens, right? If you're sitting down to talk to a listing agent and they say, this is what I think we can sell your house for, and you're like, great, cool. And there's no check-in right before it goes live to make sure that the price is good. You're kind of following that agent blindly, and that tiered structure would work very well in their favor, like we discussed. So it would work more fair for the client, the selling client, to really be on top of what you're setting the price at that point, if you're trying to incentivize a level of service using a tiered rate structure.
Oh, right? I just lost sound.
Hamish, hang on a second. I think...
From me?
There's a call coming in. We're going to send it to voicemail.
Okay. The last thing you said. I forgot to turn off this phone. My apologies.
No, you're fine. I also noticed my mic is acting up, so that's been a thing.
Hold on.
48. Right,
I think I hear you. Okay. I hear you now. Yeah, you may have to do a cut there. Yep.
Yeah, where'd you lose me?
I can hear you now.
Where did you lose me, though?
About halfway through your question. Rephrase your question.
Yeah, so if you're a selling client, you know, you have listing agents coming to check out your place, and you're meeting, interviewing your different listing agents, and you ask them kind of for evaluation, and they give you that number, and that's the number you're going with straight off the bat. You're leaving, like we said, money on the table by not necessarily checking out the competition right before going live. But also, if you're doing the tiered structure at the same time, you're not covering yourself. That's the loophole that we identified earlier, where an agent could give you a price, give you this tiered commission structure, and then play with you as far as lowballing it and getting more commission out for themselves.
Right.
Yeah. So
if they're unethical,
yeah,
they could intentionally price it low, and extract more commission for themselves and have an easier sale process. So really, the conversation needs to be about strategy. If you want to price it low to sell it fast, that's fine. You could also price it high and have a longer time on market. Price point also sets an expectation of the quality of the product, right? So it's well known, for example, designer handbags are priced insanely high, but they often sell at big discounts, right? And except at the extremes of the market. They sell it at discounts, but the initial pricing sets an expectation. So if you have a $4 million listing, it might be 3.5, but you might want to set it at 4, especially if you don't feel the pressure to sell this listing quickly, because that $4 million price point, you've set that expectation, and you also are likely to get a low offer that you're going to negotiate a discount that might be closer to 10% for a seasoned listing, versus a mid-market listing is probably, for a seasoned or stale listing, could be 3 to 5% of a discount. But a brand new listing is somewhere between 1 and 3, as long as it's not the first weekend. If it's the first weekend, it's usually listing price or more. And this norm I've now seen for 20 years. I could go find the data and show everyone the charts, but I think you'll have to just trust me on this one, that it's very common to see higher level discounts for stale high-end listings. So, you know, that's where the most important thing is to have a conversation, a discussion with the listing agent representing you on the sale of your home for what's your strategy with regard to pricing.
Right.
Are you going to go for the price it high and wait, which might be appropriate for the luxury market, but is really dumb at the entry level?
And as the client, this is your decision in totality,
well,
right?
It should, well, not in totality. Okay. So at least not in my business. And agents make their own determinations of what their practices are. But we provide a range. And mm-hmm. then we have a discussion over what's the best price point, given a lot of factors, the tranches that buyers look in, the positioning of the house in the market, the pressures on the seller to sell it quickly or wait. Maybe they're waiting for the price to eventually reach them. All of those things are part of a collaborative approach with our client. That's what we do. I don't know what other agents are doing, but it would, if you have a tiered commission structure, it creates a weird incentive to price it low. And I'm willing to compete on that because I know the agent that offered it and she is competent, but I don't think it's a good idea. Yeah. It seems like a really bad idea, actually.
Opens a can of worms, you know?
Well, it's so anytime you ask people to do something outside of the norm, you create unusual structures in the deal. And so, for example, you really don't want to list your house on a Saturday or a Sunday. Why? Well, 70 to 80% of the listings are hitting the market Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So everyone's pattern in this industry is built around that little wave function. Mm-hmm. And if you are off wave, that means a lot of buyers aren't going to see the house. A lot of agents aren't available. They've already looked at things. Like, it's a mess. You really want to list.
Yeah,
the showings are already scheduled for the weekend, and you've thrown everyone a curve. And it may sell still, but you aren't maximizing the pattern that benefits you. It's sort of like that. It's a novel structure. I'm always willing to consider novel structures, but I kind of want my clients to think about the pros and cons of this. And again, after 20 years of basically the same thing, nobody's ever taken me up on, hey, let's create something novel that works for both of us. I don't like the incentive structure in the real estate industry. Like, I get it. Not knowing how the industry works, I would say the exact same thing. But knowing how the industry works, focus on competency and integrity and service. Don't focus, like, the commissions are so similar between agents. This is not what you want to compete on.
Not your hill to die on.
But, you know, we have incredibly intelligent clients, and I've always been a contrarian too. Let me think of things in new and novel ways. So I respect that. But usually when people hear that, they get that this isn't exactly the smartest move. And so with respect to pricing, if a client wanted to price it insanely high, the answer would be, I don't think so. I think you should find somebody that believes in that price, because I've got all this data and personal and professional experience that says we're not going to get that price. Mm-hmm. There might be what we used to call in the investment community dumb money. So everyone's heard of smart money. I was telling you about this the other day. The smart money is doing this, or the smart money is doing that. But when I worked on Wall Street and when I worked in the investment community, we talked about the dumb money. And the dumb money, in some ways, were what this is. You know, I don't think this is particularly ethical, but this is what the company was focused on creating. And they were focusing on targeting those potential investors that didn't do their due diligence, that didn't know the true value of this investment, that would believe the smoke and mirrors and the hype. And those people are the dumb money. And there might be dumb money for the house, right? Somebody that's flown into the market for the weekend, has seen a bunch of not attractive homes.
Or is a poor buyer's agent.
Well, who doesn't care, right? And so this is where the Zillow model, right, of click a button and you get an agent showing up to show you a house. They are usually the least competent agents. I mean, I imagine, right, who the heck would sign up for this as a licensed agent, right? This is somebody new to the industry that probably has a full-time job doing something else that's willing to be click a button, show a house. They've done no qualification of you whatsoever, and you're just going to show up and open the door. So there is dumb money. And there might be somebody that flies in and says, I really need this house. I don't have time. My family's moving here. And all the other homes I saw this weekend are not attractive. And that's the basis of my decision. So I'm willing to pay 1.7 for the house. But the rest of the market that's been tracking it, the buyers in the market and their competent agents, hopefully, know that it's not worth any more than 1.5. But you've flown in. You're out of this market. You don't know what is a good deal and what's not a good deal. And your agent doesn't care. They don't have fiduciary responsibility or don't believe they do. Realtors do, but they don't believe they do. They're just in it for the sale. So if you're willing to pay 1.7, awesome. And we saw the same thing in Bidding Wars last year and the years before that listing in North Boulder that I called out in our Fresh Listings newsletter, where somebody paid $300,000 more than the comps. And now it's on the market for basically give me my money back and pay my commissions price. That's what it's set at. And there's no way they're going to get it because it they paid $300,000 more than the comps last year. Maybe it was worth $100,000 more because of the frenzy, but $300,000 more? They're going to be in some pain. They better be prepared for a long listing period, like many years for the market to bounce back. Because also that's a weird house. Not weird, but it's not doesn't fit the mental model of those buyers. It's a home that appeals to 10% of buyers in that price range, not 90% of buyers in that price range. So, right. And if your agent's not willing to tell you that to slow you down when you flew in from out of town, you get what you pay for in life. Like Mama said, and her mama before it. People that have personally learned this lesson in life, it's very easy to believe the sparkle. If you want to believe, you can be convinced of anything, but the reality of the market can be radically different. So if you wanted to price it really high, I would probably pass on the listing if the strategy didn't match what we're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Find somebody that believes.
When we're pricing, we tend to really play an honest game with the market, you know? I've noticed that, and we were talking about that when we were interviewing the other day. Unless there's a specific mention strategy, we are true and fair to the market, you know, and it seems it's worked the best.
Well, Hamish, it's not an honest game to the market, it's an honest game with life.
Yeah.
What's the point? I'm so uncomfortable lying about anything. and yet, there is a balance between sales. And pointing out the positive features and overcoming objections, but the approach that works best for me is one that educates people, not one that fools people. And I think that's true not just for real estate, but personally for life. And is that an honest game? I feel like it's a game that has integrity. You can look at yourself in the mirror at night, and you don't feel like you've robbed, cheated, and stolen. And there are people that like it, though. There are people, and I have a personal friend. Should I tell this story? So this is for you podcast listeners that are enjoying this all the way to the end. And I'll know you listened because this story is for you. So this is a friend who I know pretty well. And I'm hesitant to tell this story, but he has sneaky fantasies of cheating. He has never done anything.
Okay, wow, this is saucy, yeah.
Yeah, this is saucy, but he has shared with me that it turns him on, the idea of cheating. And I'm like, what are you talking about? So getting away with it, getting away with something is exciting, right? And people that practice fraud in their business life and in their personal life, you know, that cheat on each other, there's something exciting about cheating for these people in life. And I don't have that. I don't have that vibe that feels like, ooh, I got to... I mean, maybe in high school when I got away with, you know, showing up late in class and graduating. I graduated with... I've had one more day that I was absent for my English class in senior year. I was not going to graduate because I had skipped out on so... I still had good grades. I just skipped so... And usually I was out having lunch with my mom is what I was doing. But I needed to attend every single class after that. And I was trying to get away with something in high school. I was described as the Ferris Bueller of our graduating class by a good friend of mine because of the amount of shenanigans I thought it was I could get away with. I don't practice that way in life anymore. That was a period of growth for me in high school. As an adult, I want integrity in all areas of my life, but that also means reading people. And there are some people that are excited by being sneaky, by cheating. There's... The luxury home tour I'm on is using a service called SlyDial to slip into people's voicemails and leave a voice message. And you record a little message, and it doesn't ring their phone. It immediately goes to voicemail. I don't know how they do it, but I don't like it. And they asked me if I would participate and record my voice, and I said, I'm sorry. Even the name of the service bothers me. Like SlyDial is not going to work for me. I'm not a politician that needs to sneak into everyone's voicemail and say, "Hi, my name is whatever their name is running for office." No, that's not me. It's okay. It's how people. I mean, that's how people are. I'm not here to value judge. Even my friend, he's still a friend, and he shared that with me in confidence. It would make me hesitant to do a business deal with this person. Because they are turned on by being sneaky. He was being very honest, and I appreciate that. It's obvious, though. There are people that are very excited to fool you, to scam you. And it's not just about the money they make. It's about getting away with something that excites them psychologically. And it's not what works for me.
No.
It's not how I live my life.
It's not the Hal Seinstein way.
It's also not. It's not your way either, Javis. Like,
no,
we're not. This is not how we roll.
Yeah, that's the Hal Seinstein way. We're under Hal Seinstein. We wouldn't.
Yeah.
I think that's we covered the bases.
And we're at an hour, and yeah. We included a saucy story at the end for our loyal podcast listeners, all of 12 or however many. Actually, we are getting some listens. It's kind of fun.
It's decent. Yeah.
Because I do get feedback from people that have somehow tolerated me talking for an hour, mostly me.
I'm coming in a little bit more now, though.
Yeah,
some
you
more,
are.
Some and more participation.
I appreciate that. Yeah. So I'll wrap this up with, I'm Osmond with House Einstein. Oop, there's an engine revving there, Hamish. But I'm Osmond with House Einstein, and this is the House Einstein podcast. If you're looking for real estate services in Denver, in Boulder, in even as far north as Fort Collins, we're starting to do some stuff north, and we're into the mountains. We've got a listing in Breckenridge. Those are our markets, and you are welcome to find us at houseeinstein.com. We also have a great newsletter when we have time to write it called Fresh Listings. You can sign up for that right on the website at houseeinstein.com, and it's very easy to find my contact information online. So if you're looking for us, look me up. We're happy to talk to you about your real estate needs.
Alrighty. I'm Hamish. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, everyone. Have a great day.
Take care.